I want to just sort of begin by saying something about kind of trying to explain what we're going to try to do, and then we'll set about it. Our project for tonight is really to consider how a modern movement tries to hold together a commitment to an ancient, if also perennially evolving, tradition on the one hand, with the norms and expectations of a modern state on the other. And I will say I really struggled in preparing this session, much more so than with the others, in large part because there are just so many issues to raise and so many angles one could take, so much complexity to work through, not to mention a bewildering array of voices writing over the course of more than a century, taking a very broad array of perspectives. I mean, religious Zionism has always been a cacophonous kind of chorus of voices. And so I want to emphasize that we're really only going to be scratching the surface of one or two dimensions of this, and there is obviously much more to uncover. I want to do two things. One is to explore the idea that Torah deliberately chooses not to insist on or advocate for any one particular form of government, an idea that will have a variety of iterations, as we'll see. I think this is a really interesting claim, by the way, totally separate from the Zionism question. The idea that there are certain areas where halakha makes an active choice not to take a concrete position. And I want to sort of see that perhaps counterintuitive idea as it plays itself out in this setting, in the question of Zionism. And I should note here that the first part of tonight will be very heavily, but not exclusively, indebted to the scholarship of an Israeli historian named Yitzhak Geiger. And the second thing I want to do is to look somewhat closely at one thinker's attempt to argue that democracy, or at least some form of democracy, is, if you will, Judaism's first choice. It is Judaism's ideal political expression. One more word about religious Zionism before we get started. The term religious Zionism is actually a problematic label because almost everyone who uses this term actually means Orthodox Zionism. That's not entirely accurate. I mean, Martin Buber, for example, was religious, a Zionist, and understood his Zionism as in part stemming from his religion. But he and people like him are not who we tend to mean when we talk about religious Zionism. I just sort of want to acknowledge that, say that it would be an interesting topic for perhaps for me to present upon about another time, and move on. The founders of the state took for granted that the new country would be both Jewish and democratic, implicitly at first and explicitly as time went on. You can look, for example, at the Basic Law on Human Dignity, which explicitly talks about Medina Yehudit v'Demokratit, a Jewish and democratic state. Yet there have also been, especially since the late 70s and 80s, many voices in Israel. Forget about now voices in diaspora, both Jewish and non-Jewish. That's not what I want to focus on. You'll see that I'm going to constantly be delimiting our topic because it's just so big. There have been many voices in Israel who question whether Jewish and democratic really fit together as well as was conventionally thought or assumed. And that has come from two directions. First, advocates of democracy who insist that Judaism, at least in its more traditional forms, represents a threat to democratic values like equality and minority rights. And we'll be talking about minority rights, as I mentioned, next week. Even more fundamentally, the claim is that a tradition that is theonomous at its core, that is rooted in the divine law, and that does not, therefore, recognize the will of the majority in any ultimate way, cannot really be reconciled with a political system that is all about the will of the majority. And then, of course, and these are people I really don't want to talk about tonight, there are extremist, right-wing extremists who also think Judaism is incompatible with democracy, but from the other side. In other words, from the claim that who died and made democracy a Jewish ideal, in other words, okay? I should note, by the way, historically, since many of us are more than old enough to remember this, that this questioning intensified dramatically in the wake of the Oslo protests and especially the Rabin assassination, something I'm happy to talk about during the Q&A if people would like me to. And yet, it's worth saying that there is a rich and variegated tradition of reflection among religious Zionists, either reconciling with the reality of modern democracy or actively embracing or even celebrating it. And I want to look now at some voices about this idea that I mentioned at the outset, that Judaism does not actually make a choice among political systems. First, it's worth noting that this is a pretty mainstream view, meaning I didn't have to go look for sort of like radically idiosyncratic liberal religious Zionists to find this point. If you look at the first source from Rav Sharya Shuv Cohen, who was the Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Haifa for about a million years, 1975 to 2011. He was, for those interested in the history of Jewish thought, the son of Rabbi David Cohen, known as the Nazir, one of Rav Kook's most prominent students. And Sharya Shuv Cohen begins with a warning about Jewish political thought. And the truth is, it's a warning about all kinds of aspects of Jewish thought. This is what he says. I'm going to read and translate, and hopefully the translation will match because I had something to do with the translation in the first place. But, you know, you're dealing with me, so I may have changed my mind since this afternoon. Kol mi shechoshev she'efshar lakachet et ha'sifim mi'mishne Torah la'Rambam ולהפוך אותם לחוק המדינה כמות שהם, בלי להתחשב בנסיבות, הוא לא רק עם הארץ, הוא יותר מזה. הוא טועה ומטעה את הרבים. Anyone who thinks it's possible to just look at the paragraphs of the Mishneh Torah and turn them into state law as they are, without thinking about circumstances, is not only an am haaretz, an ignoramus, he's also more than that. He is astray and is leading others astray. You cannot decide modern political questions by just turning to medieval halachic sources. That is crazy talk. Why? Mishum she'Rambam atzmo haya kotev et hilchotav bifnei hamdina im bayoteha achshaviyot acheret masher hu katav otan bizmano. The Rambam himself would have written his halachic decisions when faced with a state with all of its contemporaneous problems, different than he wrote in the Middle Ages, right? You can't simply move from, let's say, a medieval feudal economy or a medieval Islamic state, right, to talking about what you would do in a modern political entity surrounded by international law, etc., etc. You can't do that. And then, in good frum form, Sharya Shuv Cohen wants to hedge and says, Lo sheha Torah mishtanet chalila. It's not that the Torah changes, God forbid. Ela hamusagim achevratiin em acherim. But rather, social conceptions differ. V'lachein hanisuach shel ha-halacha muchrach liyot mechudash. And therefore, the way you formulate halacha has to be renewed. Now, I leave it for different people on this call with different halachic ideologies or no halachic ideology at all, to decide for yourself what constitutes interpretation, what constitutes change, that is not what I want to do here. I want to see how someone wants to say, you can't make a one-to-one correspondence between the past and the present, but please don't think that's because we make up halacha anew in every generation. From the right, you might say, well, why can't you move from the medieval to the modern more easily? And from the left, you might say, okay, so you're making halakha up in every generation, but you're just not saying that, right? And Sharya Shuv Cohen is, of course, trying to walk down the middle of those two possibilities. E.F. Sharlif Sok Hayomi says, al smach nusach kadum. You can't formulate or decide law today based on some ancient medieval formulation without taking into account that which changed between then and now. Human rights discourse, the notion of freedom of religion, the notion that forcing people to practice a given religion is anathema rather than acceptable or even commonplace, right? Things like that have changed. In light of that, we can move to the to this main issue I wanted to look at, which is the idea that, again, Jewish law and tradition do not offer clear guidance, deliberately do not offer clear guidance on what political structures we should enact in contemporary times. So I want to focus first a little bit with an introduction to someone I think is one of the most interesting religious Zionist figures who in the history of the State of Israel, Reb Chaim David Halevi, who lived from 1924 to 1998 and was the Sephardic chief rabbi of Rishon LeZion and then the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv for a very long time, from 1973 to 1998. And in another lecture, I would talk about how Halevi was an incredibly interesting person because he was an extremely prominent Sephardic rabbi, the most prominent Sephardic rabbi, who refused to join the Shas party because he said, Shas claims to be a party of Sephardic pride, lahachzir atara liyoshna, to return the crown to its former glory, but it is doing so by adopting an Ashkenazi form of being Haredi. Right? Sephardim were never like this, he said. And so Rav Ovadia Yosef prevented him from ever ascending to the role of chief rabbi of Israel. We could talk about this at great length. It's a fascinating story. Halevi was a posek, a halachic decision maker, and also a theorist of halacha. And he takes a couple of steps in his halachic writing that I think are interesting and worth kind of taking a little bit slowly. Number one, the Torah is eternal, capable of responding to and offering guidance in every conceivable circumstance. Accordingly, and paradoxically, Halevi argues that in order for the Torah to be able to do that, in order for the Torah to be a Torat Chaim, a Torah of life, which he was an idea that he was preoccupied with, a living and ever-relevant Torah, it has to leave certain kinds of questions open-ended, meaning you cannot have an eternal Torah in which every last detail is determined for all time. In order for the Torah to be eternal, it has to leave certain questions open to interpretation. This is closely related to a larger view Halevi adopts, the idea that halacha is almost infinitely flexible. In a line that scandalized many of his Orthodox rabbinic peers, Halevi says at one point, "Ein gemishut kegemishuta shel halacha." There is nothing in the world more flexible than halacha. In general, Halevi takes a fairly positive approach to modernity. Technological advances, for example, he thinks, enable human beings to fulfill our role as images of God, created to rule over the created world. Here, I want to introduce a kind of conceptual distinction made by an Israeli political theorist named Moshe Hellinger from Bar-Ilan University. Hellinger makes a distinction between what he calls Demokratia Yehudit, Jewish democracy, on the one hand, and Yahadut Demokratit, democratic Judaism, on the other. Yahadut Demokratit, right, is a Judaism that has internalized and embraced certain ideas. Demokratia Yehudit, Jewish democracy, on the other hand, is a conception of democracy which has been limited by what it understands to be the norms of the Jewish tradition. If you're familiar with kind of Israeli religious politics, the notion of Jewish democracy rather than democratic Judaism is most associated with the circle of Tzvi Yehuda Cook and the yeshiva of Merkaz Harav. That is, the claim that Judaism does not really internalize any ideas from foreign ideas. There's no legitimation of Western values in contrast to democratic Judaism. Democratic Judaism means that Judaism has accepted, internalized, and even embraced a variety of democratic ideas. Women's equality, minority rights, freedom of expression, whatever, something like that. Jewish democracy, on the other hand, is the idea that the idea of democracy, not only does it not kind of penetrate Judaism, what we understand by democracy, what we consider acceptable as a democracy, is determined entirely by pre-existing Jewish norms. If this helps you, one way of thinking about this is that democratic Judaism is a far more liberal and progressive idea than Jewish democracy. In Halevi, I think we'll find some of both of these ideas. On the one hand, Halevi argues that Judaism in its essence is not democratic. He quotes that passage that we saw from Masechet Shabbat from the Talmud about God holding the mountain over the heads of the people and threatening them, right? If you accept the Torah, great, and if not, this will be your burial place. Halevi tellingly quotes that without the rejoinder to say Judaism is not democratic, right? Judaism is built on kfiya, coercion, divine coercion. Moreover, Halevi almost mocks the idea made by certain kind of liberal intellectuals that halachic tradition, because it's majoritarian, is somehow democratic. First of all, he says, the Sanhedrin was unelected. The Sanhedrin itself appointed other judges, from among whom later members for the Sanhedrin were chosen. The only place where there's a majoritarian ethos is on the Sanhedrin itself, and even then, if the minority is more learned, it trumps the majority. So he says, come on, majoritarianism, Jewish majoritarianism is extremely limited. I know we like to gather Jewish intellectuals and tell them that, like, acharei rabim lahatot, we follow the majority. He says, but that's like a really minor idea. And it's a little disingenuous. And then, sounding a little bit like what some of you might consider fundamentalists, he says, look, living under divine law is the best way to live. Whether through halakha or through the wisdom of the sages of Israel, you can solve any problem in any situation. Okay, so for many of your perspective, I imagine so far so bad, right? Because what we're basically saying is, this is, Judaism is not democratic, and let's not pretend that it is. And yet, on the other hand, he says, let's return to where I, Shai, that is, started. Halevi's argument is that halakha has what he calls tchumim netralim, neutral realms. And those neutral realms are about making space for the Jewish people at any particular time and place to make decisions about what suits it. And he makes this argument in particular about two domains of human life. He says the question of whether Judaism is capitalist or socialist is a misguided question. The answer is that Judaism has certain ideas of how human beings are meant to be treated, and then Jews are allowed in different times and places to govern themselves as they see appropriate economically. And similarly, about democracy and monarchy, if Jews decide they want a monarchy, that's great. And if Jews decide they want a democracy, that's great too. Because halakha in its eternality wants to lay out principles, but not so much concrete immutable norms. He says here, Yesh batorah shetach mesuyam bo advarim bau b'mitkaven stumim va'amumim. There is a particular realm in the Torah in which the Torah deliberately expresses itself in, with ambiguity and obscurity. Bishum panim ein limtzo batorah mishtar midini o kalkali barur. This is an amazing statement, right? Under no circumstances is it possible to find in the Torah a clear political or economic order. Afilu parashat ha-melech ba'akostuma ad shegarma lemachloket rabotenu batalmud imi bichlal mitzvah or reshut. The section about the king is so opaque that it led to a fundamental debate among the sages in the Talmud about whether having a king is a mitzvah or something merely permitted, as we've all seen. And even though halakha has been decided, like the greatest of the sages, that having a monarchy is a mitzvah, not everyone would agree with that. He's paskening here, I think, like the Rambam. You know what? The halakha may have been decided by some of the leading figures as monarchy being a requirement, he says, but go read Abravanel. It was clear that there were Jewish sages who saw democracy as fundamentally pernicious.
ומצווה זאת הלא באה להסדיר את המשטר המדיני בחברה שומרת תורה, ומדוע ניתנה בצורה סתומה ועמומה.
This law is about deciding how Jews should live, under what kind of government. Why would the Torah choose to be opaque and ambiguous here?
ונשנה הדבר בכמה משטחי החיים הנוגעים לחברי לחיי חברה ומדינה.
And the same thing is true in a variety of domains of social and political kinds.
Viladati, and in my opinion, he says, zu kocha ugdulata shel Torah.
This is part of the greatness and power of Torah, she'ein ba mishtar barur umugdar,
that it does not have a clear and well-defined system of government,
lo medini velo kalkali, neither political nor economic, v'shtei sibot ladavar.
And there are two reasons for this.
Aleph, number one, לפי מהותם של שטחי חיים אלה, ניתנים הם לשינוי מתקופה לתקופה, ותורת השם תורת נצח היא, ונמנעה במתכוון מלקבוע תחומים ברורים ומוגדרים,
right? In accord with the very essence of these kinds of questions, of these realms of human life, they change from time to time. What seems inevitable in the year 1200 seems unfathomable in the year 1948. And because the Torah is eternal, it deliberately decided not to define these terms.
And then comes another answer that is really interesting, and here you see a kind of liberal side to Halevi.
Lo ratzta Torah lachof et ha'am linhog b'chayav ha'chiloniim al pi mishtar mesuyam.
The Torah did not want to force the people in its secular lives to live according to a particular form of government,
והשאירה את הבחירה לרצונו החופשי בשטחים אלה,
and it made space for the free will of the people.
אך לאומה זאת נתנה תורה ומצוות, שהן בבחינת עקרונות ויסודות, אשר יכולות להתאים לכל משטר, בכל דור ודור, ובכל צורת חיים.
The Torah did give concrete mitzvot that are often principles and foundations that can apply and be useful and productive and challenging and uplifting no matter what political or economic circumstance we set up for ourselves.
בתכליתן למנוע תשלילי שבכל משטר אפשרי.
And the purpose of many of these economic mitzvot is to prevent the negative in every domain.
For whatever it's worth, I've tried to argue, I don't think I've published this, but I've talked about this in lectures a bunch over the years, that for Jews living in diaspora, perhaps the most interesting Jewish economic approach is to say that Judaism is meant to serve as a countercultural critique to whatever the dominant economic system is. That rather than saying, oh, I know Judaism, Judaism is socialistic or communistic or capitalistic or whatever you want to call it, what Judaism does is take the society that it finds itself in and offer a critique of where that might violate human dignity or give way to idolatry.
Many of my students will say, oh, but Judaism is anti-capitalistic, and I would suggest that that's because they're living in a capitalist society with its excesses, and therefore are doing in good Jewish form a critique of that. But they might have a different critique in a different setting.
It's interesting to note that Halevi, this is kind of a principle that he applies in a variety of circumstances. And it's really very interesting. It's almost like you can say Halevi was very nervous about something that began to happen in religious Zionism and that then proceeded to take place even more and more forcefully over time, which is he wanted to not make political questions subservient to the rule of halachic decision makers. And so he says, for example, around land for peace, when Israel is negotiating with Egypt, he says, I personally, Chaim David Halevi, am against this agreement. The halachic view is, let the government decide what's best for the Jewish people and the state of Israel. I am not poskening. My own political opinions are not halacha. And then in a really interesting example, in 1985, some of you may remember this, the Jewish state had to decide whether to return 1,150 Palestinian and Lebanese prisoners in exchange for the release of three Israeli soldiers. Rav Shlomo Goren, prominent halachic posek and religious Zionist leader, said, halacha does not permit such a trade. We don't do that kind of pidyon shvuyim, that kind of freeing captives, because it actually invites more kidnapping. Halevi's response on this was, halakha gives the government room to function as a government. Stop pretending that everything is a halachic question. By the way, the most interesting thing in many ways that Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik says about this question is when he is asked, this is something that liberal religious Zionists love to quote. Soloveitchik is asked in one of the Israeli papers for his position on land for peace. And he responds in this completely kind of like almost, I don't even know how to say this, this dismantling kind of way. And he says, I'm puzzled by why you're asking me this. I'm a rabbi. There are experts in political science and policymaking. Go talk to them. My opinion doesn't matter here. That's a kind of countercultural resistance to what one might call the totalizing of halakha, the totalization of halakha as religious Zionism develops over time. So that's Halevi. And I kind of emphasized, spent a little extra time on him because he's just a really interesting character. By the way, here's another just interesting example of Halevi. Halevi hangs out a little bit with the circle of Tzvi Yehuda Cook, kind of the right-wing religious Zionism. And like them, he assumes that the coming of the Messiah means that Israel will, the Jewish people will control more and more of the land of Israel. Then Begin makes the accord with Egypt, and the circle of Tzvi Yehuda goes extremely fierce in its critique. And Halevi says, hey, you know what? Peace is also a messianic dream. Maybe God's doing this in a different way than me and my friends planned for him. Well, that's God's prerogative, right? In other words, again, carving out space for the government to be a government rather than subdued to political, in the hands of political power. The next source on your packet, which we will not read together, is from Moshe Tzvi Neria, one of Rav Kook's most influential students, the Rosh Yeshiva at a yeshiva in Kfar HaRoeh, a moshav in central Israel, and also a member of Knesset in the early 1970s. Neria basically says the same thing. You simply can't assume that politics is fixed for all time, so there can't be one Torah view of politics. Here's a figure who is more conservative, small c, in many ways than Halevi, and kind of an argument in the same direction. Now, what Geiger, who I mentioned before, the historian Yitzchak Geiger, has shown is that there are three versions of this neutrality argument in religious Zionist circles. And I wanted to just sort of like lay them out because they're interesting. One says, look, there actually is no halachic preference, right? That's why Abarbanel can be a totally against monarchy and Rambam can be for it. That's why, you know, Rabbeinu Nissim can say what Rabbeinu Nissim says, and other people, all kinds of different people can say all kinds of different things. Halakha really takes no position on the ideal. That's position number one. Position number two, halakha prefers monarchy. But if people don't want monarchy or they feel it doesn't suit them, so they're not obligated to buy it because it's kind of a recommendation and not a requirement. After all, halakha takes the will of the people seriously. And then third are those thinkers who say, what are you talking about monarchy? It's obvious that the lechatchila Jewish position, the halachic position, ab initio, the desirable halachic position is democracy. Let's look at this for a minute. So here, first the view that the Torah's view really is open-ended. Here's Rabbi Naftali Rotenberg, who is a fellow at the Van Leer Institute, the rabbi of a small settlement in, I don't totally understand this kind of geography, of a community that used to be on one side of the Green Line and now is on the other side of the Green Line. This is above my head, a community called Har Adar. And Rotenberg says, Miyad nuchal lafchin shahogim shonim imtzu tzurot mishtar shonot kemodel haTorani ideali lefi hashkafatam v'shitatam. Immediately, when we look at the history of Jewish political thought, we see that different thinkers adopted different forms of government as the ideal Torah form of government according to their philosophy and worldview. And then he goes on, he gives you example, as Rabbi Saadia Gaon lo itrida tzurat hashilton ariboni, ela hatzlachado atifkutit. Saadia Gaon didn't really care about what the form of government was as long as it was effective, right? And then he'll go on to say, The Rambam surprised people by basically ideally favoring an oligarchy of philosophers. But most of the Rambam's own followers thought that was wrongheaded. Yosef Ibn Kaspi said, Athenian democracy is actually the Torah's ideal. Yudah Halevi comes along and says, I want a monarchy, and I can't wait for the Davidic king to be restored. Right? Other thinkers said, you know, there's one kind of worldview, one kind of political system I would want now, and another that I would want in the Messianic age. Maybe I want a monarchy then, but I sure don't want a monarchy now. And on and on and on. And Yitzhak Abarbanel has the utopian messianic view that is anti-monarchic in the extreme and is actually anarchic in the sense of thinking that we can move beyond having government at all. And until the Messiah comes, Abarbanel says, let's have something democratic in which people serve 2-3-year terms and then move on. Why does Rotenberg tell us all this? In order to say, you have to be a lunatic to conclude that there is a Jewish ideal politically. There are many, and they often come down to the political perspective adopted by the thinker. Hamaskana novat me'ayun b'shitot ha'shonot v'amuguvanot shel ha'ugim, shirak achadim mehem hizkarnu kan. The conclusion that stems from investigation of these different and varied approaches of these thinkers, only a few of which I've mentioned here, husha'ein model politi echad. There simply is no one political model. That is required and necessary. This means that we can be open to an investigation of all kinds of different political structures that come our way in time. הדמוקרטיה הליברלית המודרנית שלא הייתה מוכרת בתקופותיהם של ההוגים שהזכרנו יכולה להיות מקובלת לא פחות מכל מודל פוליטי אחר. If all of those political systems were acceptable, modern liberal democracy is no less acceptable than they are. It's just new. But so what? Jewish thinkers have always embraced new political ideas. The answer is there is no Jewish ideal, and under the table you hear Rotenberg sort of suggesting, and therefore I would advocate for democracy, although he doesn't quite say that. The view that monarchy is an ideal but is not required is in a source that is quoted all over Jewish political discussion in the 20th century, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, one of the great rabbinic figures of Eastern Europe, who basically says, look, the halachic preference is a monarchy. But if you don't want to, you don't have to. And much of the time, Jews don't want to. So they don't have to. I'll read this just quickly. You remember we saw that Deuteronomy 17 says, when you come into the land and you say, I will make myself a king. So the Netziv is really interested in this. Why does it say Ve'amarta? Why does it say this and you say? This language seems to suggest that it is not a definitive mitzvah to appoint a king, but rather permission. But the fact is, Chazal, our sages, now, one thing that it's not going to say is maybe the sages had a different view of the law than the Torah. That's not in the conceptual universe. But he says, how can it be, he says, that the Torah makes it sound like having a king is a choice when we know that the rabbinic halacha is that there's an obligation to have a king. In kein madua katuv amarta, why does it say if you decide to? V'nir'eh, it seems to me, shemishum shehanagat hamdina mishtana im mitnaheg al pidat melucha or pidat ha'am benivcharim. It seems that the reason is that the government of the state depends on whether it's ruled by a monarch or by the will of the people or their representatives. Yesh medina she'eina yichola lisbol da'at melucha. There are some societies, some countries that can't stomach the idea of a monarchy. V'yesh medina she'belo melech harei hi kisfina belo kabernit. And then there are other countries that really are like a ship without a captain if they don't have a king. V'davar ze i'efshar lasot al pi hechrech mitzvat aseh. You can't make this a definitive mitzvah, because that does not take seriously the diversity of societies and what people might find themselves wanting or favoring. Sharei b'inyan ha-shayach la-hanagat ha-klal nogea le-sakanat nefashot sheduche mitzvat aseh. Here makes this really provocative halachic argument. He says, you know, what political structure you have can actually be a question of saving lives. And saving lives would trump any mitzvah to say anyway. So there can't be a determinative law that this is how the law has to be. Rather, right, it is left somewhat open-ended. Now, I'm separating this from what Halevi said. Well, actually, I think Halevi is actually close to this position too. But the point is, this is not neutral. It seems like the Netziv is saying the halakha does prefer a monarchy. That's what the rabbinic position is. And yet, preference is not law. There are lots of things I prefer. Lots of things I would want my kids to do, I prefer them to do. I do not require it of them. Mishum kach eifshar letzavot behechlet lemanot melech kol zman shelo ala b'haskamat ha'am lisbol ol melech. Here is this really interesting quasi-democratic formulation. For this reason, it is impossible to definitively command the appointment of a king so long as the people has not agreed to bear the burden of a monarch. Al pi sheroim medinot asher tzivoteihem mitnagot b'seder yoter nachon. Because they see people around them who are perhaps being governed in a better way. Now, that question is whether the Netziv means they think it's in a better way or whether he's saying it's in a better way. There is, I guess you could say, a kind of two ways of reading him here. Is he saying halakha strongly favors monarchy but doesn't require it? Or is he saying halakha kind of favors monarchy, but we've seen things that might be as good or better? Not entirely clear, worth debating. Okay? And then finally, the position that actually some version of the following. In those days, the mitzvah of creating a government referred to monarchy. In our days, the mitzvah of creating a government obviously refers to democracy. And I want to be clear here. I don't mean this in some pejorative way, obviously. These are not like reform or conservative rabbis making this argument, right? These are pretty mainstream. Like in right now, the two people we're going to read in the Rav Kook circle making this argument. Listen to this, Rabbi Yehuda Gershoni, a really kind of interesting, I would say, the most moderate in many ways of Rav Kook's students. He says, Rak hanagat ha'am al yedei parlament nivchar shel skenim hi ha-hanaga nechona. Only governing the nation by way of an elected parliament is the correct form of government. This is quite a halachic statement. V'rak bizmanim she'adayin ein ha'am od mesugal l'shilton al yadei ha'skenim tzrichim l'sha'al l'shilton yachid v'dok b'zeh. Only at times when the people are not ready yet to be ruled by multiple people do we allow them to be ruled by one person. And then he says, pay close attention to this. As if he's speaking here to a lot of his, you know, pro-monarchic friends. He then says, "Mivuar bidvarav shel anetziv shekol zman sheyesh haskamat ha'am lenahel medina yedei nivcharei ha'am ein ha'mitzvah limnot melech lemanot melech." Right? It is clear, he says, from the words of the netziv, that any time, as long as the will of the people is to be governed by representatives, there is, of course, no mitzvah to appoint a king. Why would there be? V'rak sheyesh drisha min ha'am lemanot melech v'cholim lisbol ol shel shilton yachid az yesh mitzvah al ha-sanhedrin lemanot lehem melech. Right? Only when the people want it and can bear it, then there becomes a mitzvah to appoint a monarch. But obviously, there's no mitzvah if the people don't want it. This a little bit is reminiscent of something that Rav Kook, I hadn't really thought about this, but this is reminiscent of something that Rav Kook says in a very famous argument. He says, you know, the authority of the king derives from the people. After all, they're the ones who say in Deuteronomy, we want to have a king. And so if they don't appoint a king, the authority belongs to them to appoint what they want instead. So it's almost like the king is an elected official. Because he depends for his power on the will and acceptance of the people. And then, in a similar way, Rabbi Yehuda Shaviv, one of the founders of Yeshivat Har Etzion, one of the more, I guess you would say, moderate religious Zionist yeshivot, he says, "Nitan lelechtzad nosav lefareshet hakatuv asim alai melech bechol agoyim." It's possible to explain the verse, "I will place a king upon me, like all of the nations, b'mashma shel kol shilton shehu." It doesn't mean I will appoint a king. It means I will form a government for myself. Now, we could talk some other time about how compelling this is as an exegesis of the verses, as opposed to a political theory. Lemor, in other words, that is to say, im ritzono shel ha'am l'sagel atzmo ma'arechet shiltonit mosadit kimkubal ba'amim ha'achirim rashayhu. If you want to have a government like the other people around you have, you're permitted to. V'reshut zeh mekabelet gushpanka shel malav hofechet mitzvah. This gets a hechsher, as it were, an authorization from heaven, and becomes a mitzvah. And then he goes on to say, in the old days, that meant there was a mitzvah to appoint a king, because if you wanted to be like everyone else, you would appoint a king. But later, when everybody knows that democracy, direct democracy, is the best political ideal, so that's the mitzvah. The mitzvah, in other words, is to appoint the best political system known to people at that moment. And that means, really interesting argument, that the mitzvah of appointing a king in a modern society is the mitzvah of creating a democracy. Because a king was only an example. It's not a king bidafka. It's not a king specifically. It's what a king represents. I give you other examples here. Rav Yoel Binun, an incredibly complicated and colorful figure in the religious Zionist world. One day he's a right winger, one day he's a left winger. He's a very complex figure. Basically, in this really interesting interview that I gave you an excerpt from, he says to his interviewer, "Look, like everybody else, when I started out, I thought the halacha was monarchy. And then I actually started trying to understand what the values were that were underlying Jewish political discourse in the Bible and in Chazal, and I realized that you have to be a lunatic to think that the monarchy is the ideal. Obviously, democracy is halacha's first choice." And then I wanted you to see something really, really interesting, and it's a good transition to what I want to do very briefly for the second part. Shimon Federbusch, a rabbi in Poland, had the great zchut of being the chief rabbi of Finland, which is a great title that I myself aspired to. And then for 40 years was a rabbi in the United States, a religious Zionist leader among the founders of the religious kibbutz movement. Some of you grew up in homes reading Hadoar, where he was a regular contributor. Federbusch was a really interesting character. And he argues in Source 9, that I leave to you to read, that the mitzvah of appointing a king is kind of like when the Torah allows a soldier to marry a captive woman, but then says, "I want you to be really careful about affirming her dignity within the law." I'm not defending that law here. That is not my point. But his point is, there are a variety of laws in the Torah that are concessions to human weakness that are meant to be overcome over time. And his chiddush, his innovation is that the law of appointing a king is an example of precisely that. Right? The same way, and he says, this is like sacrifices. The Torah doesn't want sacrifices. It concedes that some people have a need to bring sacrifices, but ultimately want to get beyond that. Similarly, with a monarchy, right? You can't just simply say to people who live in a world surrounded by monarchy, "No more monarchy." It doesn't actually make sense. What you do is, and this is something that we saw in the first session, you allow monarchy, but you strip it down to the point where it's barely monarchy at all, and it becomes clear, hopefully, that you're not in favor of a monarchy. Now, I want to talk about Federbusch's book, Torah Umlucha, is that what it's called? In which he makes this really interesting set of arguments on behalf of democracy as an ideal. And I want to just sort of say, Federbusch is a minority opinion. He does not carry the day in terms of all of his arguments, but I find him to be a really interesting example of trying to remain faithful to a tradition and its authority on the one hand, while embracing modern political ideals at the same time. And Federbusch begins with the following interesting claim, and this is a response to a question a couple of you have sent me over email. He says, there are two very different ways that people use the word theocracy. Originally, as the term was coined by Josephus, theocracy refers to being ruled by God and God alone, since God is king and therefore no one else can be. But over time, he says, the term took on a new and very different, and in some ways, he argues, antithetical meaning. That is, being ruled by a priestly class from one religion, what some historians call a hierarchy. I can't even say that word. Properly speaking, that is not a theocracy at all. Theocracy means that you are ruled only by God. Some of you may hear echoes of Martin Buber here if you're familiar with Buber's book, The Kingship of God. The Kingdom of God, I think it's called. And you'd be right. In other words, this notion that theocracy, if anything, undermines the very idea of anyone being destined to rule over anyone else. Almost needless to say, this second form of theocracy, which he says is not theocracy at all, but hierocracy, comes with discrimination against people committed to other religions, obviously. Now, Federbusch's argument is that this second type of theocracy, that is, being ruled by a priestly class, never had any place in ancient Israel. On the contrary, the religious idea in the Torah is the conceptual basis of being ruled by the people rather than by some kind of priestly class. In the Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael, we have the following really interesting comment, which I admit I learned only from reading Federbusch's book. Vatem tiyuli, you shall be for me, mamlechet kohanim and goy kadosh, however you want to translate that, a kingdom of priests and a holy people. So the Mechilta says, kivyachol eini ma'amid ve'eini mashlit aleichem acherim ela ani. What this means is, you will be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. That is to say, I do not appoint or set up over you any ruler except for myself. This is the Mechilta posing as Martin Buber. This is a remarkable text. And in fact, in Israel, there was never priestly rule, says Federbusch. And he quotes this beautiful passage in Ramban, where Ramban is explaining the verse that says that there will always be a staff, a kind of royal staff in Judah. And Ramban basically goes on and says, the only time that there was ever a priestly rule in Israel was the Hasmoneans. And we know that the sages didn't like them. And in fact, they suffered greatly as a punishment, because it's one thing to be a heroic priest, but a priest is never meant to be a king. Look at the passage from the Talmud Yerushalmi, source 13. Ein moshchim kohanim melachim. We do not make kings out of priests. For Federbusch, this is so fundamental, because he says, we are against theocracy in the sense that people use that word. We always have been. We are for theocracy in the sense of being ruled only by God. And then he's going to want to make this interesting move that says, and that grounds democracy, because the whole point is everyone's equal under God. That's the whole point of a theocracy. Nobody is hierarchically above anybody else. And then Federbusch argues that the halachic ideal is a separation of powers. How come? You can't put religious observance under the authority of the state because mitzvot, here we're going to move from the Bible. Notice what he does here. Because mitzvot, at least by Talmudic times, can no longer legally be enforced, and their infraction cannot be punished by a court. By the time of the Talmud, he says, the observance of religious norms is on some level voluntary, commanded, but not legally enforced. The state has a lot of authority in the realm of interpersonal relations and the relations between the citizens and the state, but this is separate from the laws of the Torah around things like mitzvot ben adam lemakom, commandments between a person and God, and also separate in the way that Rabbeinu Nissim suggested, right? What a state can do is not necessarily bound only by what the Torah law is. And basically what Federbusch argues is, if you really care about religion in this state that we're forming, this book comes out in 1951. If you care about religion, you should be invested in creating a religious authority in the state whose job is purely inspirational. It has no authority to force anyone to do anything and shouldn't. If you want to fund it, give it money to hire teachers. And so what Judaism requires, he says, is free exercise of religion and providing for the material needs of a religious authority to inspire the society. This is not the full separation of church and state, but also granting no enforcing authority to the state religious authority. And then he says, following a tradition that we're going to find developed both before and after, especially in the religious kibbutz movement, that the real aspiration of religion in this state is to influence it to be animated by chesed and generosity, to insist that its laws be rooted in justice, so that the Torah's vision of justice can be realized in a concrete place on earth. Those who are truly committed to Judaism can never give up on the idea that a Jewish state, a Jewish democracy, will embody the highest ideals of Judaism. Now, what a cynic might say, and it's worth always keeping this in mind, is, lo and behold, whenever any Jewish thinker talks about Judaism's highest ideals, they coincide very greatly with his or her own. Right? This thing, I think, if I remember correctly, Tamar Ross says somewhere in a review of Eliezer Berkowitz. She says, Eliezer Berkowitz says, you know, norms change in light of the eternal ideals. What are the eternal ideals? The things Eliezer Berkowitz still believes in. Right? But that's a kind of the hermeneutic circle that we're all stuck in. Meaning, I don't think that that's disqualifying. It's just worth being a little self-critical about. Fetterbush says, some states separate religion and state to protect the state from religion, and some to protect religion from the encroachments of the state. Since the majority in Israel is going to be secular, we should also be attuned to protecting religion from them. Right? We want the free practice of religion. The only way that makes sense is if religion and state, in terms of power, are separated. And then he'll invoke language that we've seen, Mishpat HaMlucha versus Mishpat HaTorah, the law of the king versus the law of the Torah. About religious coercion, he says, look, in our times, it is commonly agreed, of course, by whom is an important question, that religious coercion is repulsive and disgusting, mito'av. Empirically, he says, where religion is coerced, it is rebelled against. And where religion exercises ethical influence and models religious dedication and self-realization, it turns people on to live lives of love and faithfulness. Don't coerce people, he says again and again, inspire them. If this is helpful, in this sense, whether consciously or not, Fetterbush is a student of Moses Mendelssohn, right? Religion should exemplify and instruct, not coerce. And then he wants to say, listen, more secular people, don't worry about religion taking over. First of all, he says, and I would love to know exactly what he's referring to here in his own mind, the Torah's own vision of the state prohibits discrimination based on religion. I don't know. That would not have been my conclusion from reading the book of Deuteronomy. He's clearly thinking about something, and I'm not sure what. And he says, again, to belabor this point, but he comes back to it again and again. In ancient Israel, there was an abstract theocracy, the belief that God is ruler of all humanity, and never, therefore, the permission for the religious leaders to rule over the people. The religious leaders are not synonyms for God, quite the contrary. If anything, the biblical conception of theocracy lays the groundwork for a more developed notion of equality. And then he says beautifully, because he's like a thinker after my own heart, there's no room for tyranny in a religion that actually believes and doesn't just say that God dwells with the weak and downtrodden rather than the powerful and the mighty. After all, this is a religion that says Moshe's highest character trait is humility. Fetterbush goes on to argue, interestingly, that all societies start out egalitarian. This is a huge debate among academic Bible scholars about to what extent the original community in Israel, in ancient Israel, was egalitarian. But he wants to argue that during the time of the tribes, there was equality, and that the Torah emphasized that they were all former slaves precisely so that they would realize that they all share a certain social status, or if you prefer, a certain lack of social status. And therefore, you could have what he calls shivyon chevrati muchlat, complete social equality. In other words, the argument is, I'll just say this in one more way, in any society that truly sees God as its ruler, any presumptive human ruler is robbed of total legitimation. By the way, this is straight Spinoza. Spinoza says Israel was conceptually a theocracy and therefore practically a democracy. That therefore is everything. It was conceptually a theocracy, and that is what made it practically a democracy. Alan Mittleman, professor of philosophy at JTS, describes this in the following way. Federbusch wants to uphold the idea of theocracy and transvalue it for the sake of democracy. What is a theocracy? It's a society where everyone is equal under God. Now, in contrast to Halevi, Federbusch will quote the Gemara on Shabbat about holding the mountain over their heads, but he will say, what is the most important part of that sugya? Obviously, it's the part where they say a contract under duress is not binding. And so he says the very meaning of covenant is bound up with consent. The sages told us that. And he wants to argue that this is an attendant piece of monotheism. Where God is ruler, there is no room for legislation that the people do not accept. And what you have on your source sheet is places in later halakha that he wants to argue also play out the democratic ideal. The notion that a community cannot withstand a norm means that the norm is not binding, not a decree. That even if something is decreed and the community later realizes that it can't accept it, that decree is canceled, which is also made law by Maimonides. And so we have here, he says, essentially not just biblical democracy, but Talmudic democracy, and even post-Talmudic democracy with the notion that you can't have a communal leader unless the community supports that person being their leader. Now, I want to just end this discussion of Federbusch by pointing out this doesn't all work. This is like a first sketch, and it has many seams that show, right? On the one hand, Federbusch will say things like, even a non-Jew can serve as the prime minister of this state, since after all, whoever the people want can serve as the leader of this state. On the other hand, he also says some things that are, by modern standards, remarkably illiberal. He says, I mean, he's writing in 1951 when he's nervous about a Jewish settlement there, but he says, it will be forbidden to Jews to leave the land without permission. They need an exit visa, since after all, halachically, it's forbidden to Jews to leave the land of Israel. Right? It's also forbidden for them to give control of the land to others, right? This would get in the way, presumably, of a government that wanted to, say, make territorial concessions in the name of peace. Meaning, all of a sudden, you find Federbusch going from being this kind of, like, theologically grounded liberal Democrat to this, wait a minute, I'm paralyzed by halachic sources that say very illiberal things that I also feel bound to. And this is not worked out. Meaning, it's like, the seams really show here very dramatically. He does not have, I think, and this is something that Alan Mittleman has argued, a clear-cut plan for how to separate spheres of authority, even though he clearly thinks that separating spheres of authority is essential and elemental. What you have, though, is here an attempt to situate the birth of the state of Israel in an ongoing political tradition. It's a way of saying, on the one hand, this is like a novum, a new thing. On the other hand, the terms of tradition can still speak to it and about it. And interestingly, they end up saying many of the same things that modern liberal democratic theory would in fact say. And then will come an argument that is very common, by the way, common among many Christian historians as well. The idea that, in fact, modern democratic norms are biblical in origin in the first place. For example, that we would have no notion of equality without Genesis 1. It was something we could talk about. Isn't this the same debate that we are having in American law on how we interpret a constitution? Is living document, or do we look at original public meaning of the words? I don't know when you wrote that, Howard, But there are obvious parallels between American debates about the Constitution and Jewish debates about the unfolding of Jewish law. There's a lot to talk about here, though, also about clear differences, about what happens when a law is imagined as divine as opposed to human, and what that really means and what its implications are. According to Halevi, are rabbis restricted to paskening halakha and not able to comment on the Torah's values as it engages with modern society and government? The answer to that, I don't know at what point you ask that, but the answer to that is no. They are able to comment on the Torah's values as they see it, as it engages with modern society and government. But they should not confuse their own political opinions as having the status of law. Halevi says, I think the peace agreement with Egypt is a bad idea, but I also don't think it's the law. I'm in favor of X, Y, and Z, but the point, one of the things he wants to do, I think very self-consciously, is carve out space for a government to be a government without constantly having to make phone calls to rabbis to get permission. Like, I think he would have found the idea of, like, you know, a prime minister calling a posek for a decision about a political question problematic. Calling to get advice, sure, but calling to get a halachic decision is a crossing of a line that a posek is not supposed to be in. I didn't say that in clear language, but I think it's crossing over into a realm that is not entirely his. Adrian says, as many of the world's governments seem to be leaning towards more authoritarian rule, would the scholars say the Torah leans toward democracy? Well, actually, it's funny that you ask that, because one of the funny problems of an argument that says that the Torah doesn't have a clear position is that one could then argue, well, the Torah is in favor of autocracy. The Torah is in favor of authoritarian government when the people want that. What happens when the people elect Donald Trump? Is that what the Torah thinks is the ideal? Meaning, you want to give people authority, but what do you do when people do extremely dumb and dangerous things? Do you then give that the weight of Torah? Right? So I think your question is really actually quite important, right? Because what I think your question, Adrian, if I understand you correctly, reminds us of is the Torah doesn't just want to validate what people do. It also wants to critique it. So we have to find space for that as well. Right? And that's the danger of this kind of argument. This kind of argument is based on showing, I mean, here I could say something that's going to sound wildly anti-democratic, and you'll quote me out of context, and I'll have to deny that I said this, but this is all based on the desire to create ample space for the people's will to be expressed. But what happens when the people's will is toxic? Where's the role of the prophetic here? Right? So I think that that's actually, your question is actually a really important challenge, it seems to me. Michael asks, for those who think Judaism prefers democracy or at least permits it, how would they explain the constant emphasis in the Bible on restoring the house of David to leadership? That is a good question. I think that in some ways, one of the most interesting ways of doing that is by saying, what we pray for in the Messianic era is not what we pray for now. Yeah, that's then. Tell you what, when the Messiah comes, you can set up a king. Tell you what, you can have a king. But that's not what we're going to do now. And what they also might say is, what will this king be? This king may function in democratic ways. In other words, don't think about a king as a medieval nightmare who oppresses his people. In some ways, I think you can say, I'm a little bit out on a limb here in a field that I don't really kind of control, but for some thinkers, the fantasy of a Davidic king is a tiny bit embarrassing. So you have to find a way to neutralize or weaken it a little bit, or at least decentralize it. Because if you think of the Messianic period as the perfected world, it's odd to imagine bringing back a monarch when you think democracy is a better way of living. So what you might do is reduce a monarch to a purely symbolic kind of role. In modern monarchies, the sovereign is nearly powerless. Is this the kind of monarchy that the advocates of the Torah's preference for monarchy would find to be valid? Well, I don't know the answer to that question, but that is certainly what Deuteronomy... Andrew, if you were here in the first lecture, that's exactly what Deuteronomy argues for, essentially a disempowered monarch. You want a king? I'll give you a king. I'll just make him a kingala as opposed to a king. No power, no nothing. Like, fine, call it a king. What can he do? He can go to the Beis Medrash and read the Gemara all day. Sounds perfect. That's literally the king that's imagined. I mean, not literally, because, right, but Deuteronomy's king sits around and reads the Torah. That's what he does. That's what he does all day. He has no army. He has no role in the political at all, right? So if those people feel that way, then they're on good biblical terms. And as we saw in our second session, we have the interesting development that despite all that, a major voice and arguably the dominant voice in rabbinic literature ends up thinking that a monarch is a mitzvah. And we talked about the way that the Bar Kokhba moment may or may not be the right explanation for how that could possibly come about. Last question here, Alyssa Cushman, is there something different about the role of rabbis in family matters? Was there a particular religious justification for having the separate religious courts in Israel for matters of marriage and divorce? I mean, in general, I think it's fair to say that David Ben-Gurion made a series of calculations about what he could hand over to a religious leadership he thought was largely moribund anyway. And then it turned out, you know, it's like in America. If you read sociologists in like the 1960s, they're all talking about how orthodoxy is dying out. And then orthodoxy won. I think it's a similar dilemma in Israel, right? Like when you tell the Haredim, who are 50 people, that they don't have to go to the army, it's a problem, and then they become, you know, some massive percentage of the country. So all of this has to do with those kinds of questions and the inability in coalition politics to undermine some of those arrangements. But it's a discussion we could have another day. And there are also people far more qualified to discuss it than me. Okay, thank you very much. Next time, I don't know what I'm going to say exactly, but I'm going to try to talk a little bit about how some of these thinkers have formulated arguments about minority rights, some that you'll find inspiring and some that you'll find a little terrifying. We'll watch a tradition really struggling to find a way to embrace a modern idea or not. Okay, thank you all very much. Have a good week.